We were talking about instrument of music in New Testament worship last time. We left off in about page 244 of the edition of the book that I have. So in a couple minutes, that's where we'll pick up. There are some quotes that we'll review, some quotes from some people who were relatively famous in some well-known denominations several years ago. But before we do that, it might be instructive to think about, as we talk about instrument of music, with people who maybe have not considered that as far as its absence in New Testament worship. Maybe they've not considered why we would want to omit that. Maybe in their minds there are some arguments for using it. Let's kick around as a class some of the things that we've heard and then look at those arguments as far as whether or not they're good arguments. When you think about people saying, okay, we should have instrumental music in worship, what are some of the arguments that you hear? Gary? Sometimes people will frame it in terms of cost, especially if you have a very modest structure. Maybe you have a small number of people, so they're thinking, well, you don't have enough people for choir, or you're too small to have a piano player, an organ player, or there's not enough space for a piano and organ. And a person may just come right out and ask. I've had that experience a few times over the years, and that may not be as popular now as it was because buildings have typically been supersized. And if you've got enough money to pay for a supersized building, you've probably got enough money to pay for a piano. But that is one of the things that can generate a spiritual discussion. What else? Stan?
God gave me the talent, and I should be able to use it.
Okay. We talked about that a little bit last time, people looking at their talents, and just because God has given you a talent, does that necessarily mean that that talent should be somehow used in worship? But there will be some people, if you make that argument, we gave some illustrations last week, but what about dance? Are there some people who are good dancers? Are there some people who are good twirlers? Some people who are good cheerleaders? I mean, you can just go down a list and say people are talented in these various areas, but talent does not necessarily translate into that's something that would be appropriate or suitable or authorized for worship. What else do we hear as far as an argument for instrumental music in worship? It's our preference. We get more out of worship that way. I don't like to sing. But you're back to one of the things that we've talked about earlier, and that's God's authority. We'll talk a little bit more about that tonight. Has God authorized, do we have God's stamp of approval for instrumental music in worship? But people sometimes have a strong preference for it, or sometimes not for it. Joe?
Music has a way of getting your emotions worked up. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you're watching a scary movie, if you turn off the sound, you're not scared anymore. So it has a way of, you know, whatever, if it's a really sad scene, the music brings out your feelings of sadness more. And I think some people like that experience of, you know, the music adding to there.
Anybody ever play any kind of game? Maybe you've gone into a video game place, or maybe you played a game on a phone. How many people have played a game somewhere? Not too many, will admit it, but I suspect that several have. I had, when I was probably about 12 years old, and I don't know what caused this friend to make this point, but it stuck with me over the years. It was just such a new idea. I was playing a lot of video games at the time, and he said video games and pinball machines, that kind of thing, he said they would not be nearly as much fun if there were no sound. Now, I'd never thought about that before. But I've had the chance a few times over the years to have access to the insides of a machine, a pinball machine or a video machine, and actually turn the sound off. You might be surprised at the difference that it makes, but when you strip out the sound, there is a huge, huge difference. He was right. It's not nearly as fun. And for a lot of people, if that's what they have been accustomed to, the big pipe organs, or there's somebody over here in the piano, to strip that away for them, it's a shock. So for a lot of people, we need to remember that taking away that aspect of worship for them, it's going to be probably in their mind a big deal. But again, you come back to the question of what has God authorized, what does God want? We recognize that that may be a huge change for you, but still, if we're trying to do what the Bible says, then this is what we need to follow as far as God's word and not personal preference. Anything else?
My voice doesn't sound good, so the piano kind of covers that up.
Okay. How would you respond to that one? I don't have the best voice.
I don't either.
All right.
I can't hear it.
All right. Maybe you are bold and honest, so you might give them that response. Anything else that you might say? All right. I think you can make that point. It's not about the voice quality. For example, if you made that argument, you might say, well, you know, I'm not the best communion passer. I rattle the tray. Well, that's okay. I'm not the best Bible class teacher. I'm not the best grass mower. I'm not the best, and you can just go down the list. You don't have to be the best or have the best to do a lot of things in life, and that includes serving God. Gary, we'll go back to you for a minute. Yeah, I'm not going to leave behind my ketchup. I understand your argument. I know where you're going with that. Yes, your point is exactly right. I think of it almost in terms of somebody who heavily deodorizes a room. You're trying to cover up something rather than just have the natural scent or the natural fragrance. That's the better way to go. But a lot of times people think, I'm going to cover up the voice, or the singing is so poor congregationally we can be helped by this instrument. So those are a lot of the main arguments that we hear. Anything else? You've obviously got David used it in the Old Testament. We've talked about that. Anything else? Some would put it in the expedient category. They would say this is an expedient. This helps us carry out worship. But it's not an expedient. What is it? It is an addition. It's going beyond. It's not a way to help us carry out worship. Now you're talking.
Some people down south have started doing that to try to help their singing get better.
Yes. That would be a different discussion. That would be a different discussion. Now you're talking about a slightly different realm. You're talking about leading songs,
right,
and leading them in a different way versus. Anybody ever been in a congregation where you had two song leaders same time? I think Warsaw has tried that. I'm not 100% sure about that. But that would be a big change for us. But can you see a set of circumstances where two song leaders might be helpful? Well, that could be true.
Part songs where one half of the group is singing, the other half comes in later.
That could be true. What if you had a congregation that was composed of, let's say, English-speaking people and Spanish-speaking people, and you wanted to sing together? Might you have one song leader that was skilled in English, another song leader that was skilled in Spanish, and they bring them together? Sure. What if you've got a congregation of 5,000 people? Now, maybe one song leader could do it, but maybe because of how the building is structured, let's just say, and this probably wouldn't be the best arrangement, but let's say that you had a circular building. If you were going to lead singing in that structure, you know, would you be on some kind of revolving platform? That probably wouldn't work well, that you would just be circling around. But if you had, you know, one in front or one in back, or you could actually have four, one on each side, you know, north, south, east, and west. So just because we have one song leader, that's a reminder that we need to make sure that we separate what tradition is from what truth is. And like I say, there are people who have looked at some changes. Not all of those are bad. Some of those would fall into, we would say, either the non-expedient category, or they would fall into the change category in the sense of not being authorized by God. But change is not necessarily evil or bad. Just because we've done it this way for the last X number of years and another congregation does it slightly differently, once again, that does not mean that we're right and they're wrong. Everything has to be looked at independently on a case-by-case basis.
The places that we've been where that's happened, it's turned out that, as Julie said, there may be four, there may be any number, but a number of those were ladies. And if you put that into the leadership category,
yeah,
it's really...
Yeah. You go back to what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 6. Even if all things are lawful, not all things are expedient, wise, good, helpful, smart. And that would certainly fit. Where if you're doing that with some ladies, you know, miking them, putting them up front and so forth, that may not be sinful, but you're certainly opening up a can of worms or possibly heading down a road which is going to get you in a whole lot of trouble and definitely be off course. Anybody else? Okay, let's take a look at our book. As you look at page 244, he talks about no instruments in any church from the Reformation movement. He goes back and talks about people like John Calvin, French theologian, Bible scholar, Reformation movement influence, musical instruments, and celebrating the praises of God. This is a quote from Calvin. Would be no more suitable than the burning of incense, the lighting of lamps, and the restoration of the other shadows of the law. The Baptists, therefore, have foolishly borrowed this, as well as many other things from the Jews. Now, this is a fella. He was not from our side of the fence, spiritually speaking, but he was a very influential man, and this was what he wrote. Adam Clark, again, not quite from our side of the fence. He was from a Methodist background, British Methodist theologian, again, a Bible scholar. He says, I'm an old man, and here I declare that I've never known them, that would be musical instruments in worship, to be productive of any good in the worship of God, and have reason to believe that they are productive of much evil. Music as a science I esteem and admire, but instrumental music in the house of God I abominate and abhor. He said, this is the abuse of music, and I here register my protest against all such corruption of the worship of the author of Christianity. As you look at these quotes, you have to think about where these guys are coming from. In our last class, I told you if you go back about 200 years, 250 years, it was very, very difficult two or three centuries ago to find religious groups which used instrumental music in worship. That's just not how it was done. It was a cappella singing, singing without instruments of music. And these guys, smart guys, fellows who really studied the Bible, they're, for the most part, back in this period of time. And people were talking about introducing instrumental music, and this is their reaction to it. It is abhorrent. I object. It's just not suitable for the house of God. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily mean just because they're saying this is abhorrent, does that mean it's wrong? Just because somebody says something that's wrong, that doesn't prove it one way or the other. But at least they're raising some questions about this. That should cause people to go back and inquire, is this really contrary to God's will, or is this acceptable to God, and these people are just, you know, hollering about something that there's really nothing to worry about. Gary, did you have a thought?
Just kind of, I think it was around the same time frame, 150 years ago, that up until then, Christians didn't view, well, quote-unquote Christians didn't view Christmas as a religious holiday, but that seems to, all of this seems to be changing about the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. You have a lot of things that were sort of rethought, revised a little bit, and you have to go back and once again look at all those items individually and say, where are we at? Is it a matter that matters to God or not?
And I wonder if that's with our declaring independence from Britain, if we're, you know, everyone's like, oh, we get to rewrite our own ways and oh, we get to come up with new things, and then they just kind of went a little too far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wasn't there, obviously.
Yeah. Well, none of us were. Religious freedom is a great thing. Freedom in general is a great thing. But people can take freedom and go way too far with it. And in some cases, that's what's happened with religion. John Knox, that name may seem familiar to you, maybe not. Scottish clergyman, notary priest, founder of the Presbyterian denomination, Scottish Reformation leader. Knox considered the organ the devil's kiss to whistles and had the one, that is the organ, in the High Kirk of Edinburgh removed. And that's taken from McClintock and Strong, a very famous encyclopedia. Martin Luther, German monk, professor, theologian, considered to be the father of the Protestant Reformation movement. The organ in the house of worship is the insignia of Baal, a sign of the devil. The Roman Catholics borrowed it from the Jews. Charles Spurgeon, he was a famous Baptist preacher and British descent. We do not need them. That would be instruments of music and worship. They would hinder rather than help our praise. Sing unto him. This is the sweetest and best music, no instrument like the human voice. What a degradation to supplant the intelligent song of the whole congregation by the theatrical prettiness of a quartet, bellows and pipes. We might as well pray by machinery as praise by it. When asked why, he quoted 1 Corinthians 14:15. I will pray with the Spirit, and I will pray with the understanding also. I will sing with the Spirit, and I will sing with the understanding also. That was from his commentary on Psalm 42. Spurgeon preached to 20,000 people every Sunday for 20 years. And it gives you the place. And never were mechanical instruments of music used or allowed in those services. Then you have John Wesley, another famous person, an Anglican cleric, theologian, founder of Arminian Methodism. I have no objection to instruments of music in our worship, proceeded that they are neither seen nor heard. So you have all of these guys, people who exerted a great deal of influence, power, men who wrote volumes and volumes. And as you look at page 246, the middle of the page, when the Reformation movement started, Reformation leaders were unanimous or nearly unanimous in agreement. They rejected the use of all instrumental music in the worship services, and in some cases, they looked at it as a thing of idolatry and a device of demons. Calvin, Clark, Knox, Luther, Wesley, all were in agreement. Mechanical instruments of music were not seen nor heard in worship. But as you start looking at time, and you see this in the Old Testament, remember the people didn't have a king. They start looking around. They see the other nations. They have kings. So one day, what did the people say? We need a king. And it's the same principle over here. People were thinking, hey, they've got an instrument, they've heard about it, and that sounds good to us, and we want an instrument. And that's exactly how it happened. He says, however, musical instruments would later make their way into almost every one of those Reformed denominations. And that's exactly right. You can look around today and see that that's exactly correct. Today, instruments in churches are loved, they're praised, they're lauded, they're adored, they're applauded, and embraced as vital necessities for stimulating worship. And then, Gary, that goes back to what you were saying. This is what we've got to have. And if it wears out, we need to get a new one. That's just the way people think. Top of page 247, in most men's minds, you could not possibly have a worship service without an instrument. As a matter of fact, most people today believe that not having an instrument of music and worship is some kind of blasphemy. And it's almost a given. People, if you don't have it, want to know why. They think that you're strange, odd, weird, and nobody's ever done it that way. And that's simply not true. Towards the bottom of 247, the instrumental music issue may or may not be a big deal in a person's mind and heart. Ultimately, it boils down to a simple question. Am I willing to do what God has said do? And that's a question about every aspect of Christianity. How to become a Christian? If God's given a plan, are you willing to follow it or not? If God has told you what to do when it comes to worship, Christian living, morality, are you willing to do it or not? That ends the chapter. Anything that you wanted to ask before we start talking about the next section? Okay. Chapter 28, Don't Ever Call Me Reverend. Talks about one of his service calls at Vanderbilt Medical Center, and he was doing some troubleshooting, completing a mountain of related paperwork, looked at his watch, it was 5 p.m. So he was ready to hit the bricks, head out the door, and say, get out of the way. See you in the morning, what? Reverend. Now, if you are associated with the church and you are a preacher or you call a preacher reverend, you'll probably get some kind of reaction. And that's exactly what happened here, though we don't believe that Randall was a preacher, at least not in the full-time sense. Wait up, Mr. Mike, said Randall. Yeah, I turned to look at Randall. My friend, don't ever call me reverend. He was not criticizing. His tone wasn't harsh. He was simply instructing. Now, if you heard that from somebody, you might be thinking, well, it's a joke, or maybe it's a backhanded compliment, or maybe it's a real compliment. You know, you're reverend. And you may have heard people say, well, you're reverend. Maybe they'll say you're pastor or you're a preacher occasionally, but oftentimes it's reverend. Anybody ever see a parking lot space, reverend parks here? They're not uncommon. And as you look at other items in society, a lot of that is geared towards the people who are referred to as reverend. He mentions, this is back in the book of Psalms, Psalm 119, he hath sent redemption unto his people, he hath commanded his covenant forever, holy and reverend is his name. Now I've seen some people defend the idea that, you know, here they're not really saying that reverend, quote unquote, is the name of God. It is simply a description of honor, and it would be appropriate for God. But just as we would say a person is loving and, you know, God is also loving, that this is not a description which would necessarily be applicable only to God. I'm not so convinced by that. I also probably would not take the other extreme where you might find some people who would run back to this passage and say, aha, you know, this is the reason that you would want to avoid saying reverend. I'm not sure that's maybe necessarily the best argument. What might be a better argument, or at least another argument?
We're all equal.
Yeah. In Christ, all are equal. If that's true, then you can't have what? Carol just needs to fill in that blank. If all are equal, then you can't have a reverend, can you? Because that would mean that someone is higher, someone is not equal to everybody else. So if that principle is true, and it's affirmed in numerous places, the idea of having a reverend or somebody who's going to be the clergy lady system, that cannot be correct. That has got to be false. He mentions that reverend is an adjective. It does describe the name of God. It's a word intended and used for God alone. As I said, there's some people who try to argue that point. How successful that can be done, I guess that's going to be left to some Hebrew scholars. Randall, every time I'm around you, I learn something new. And every time you teach me something, it's backed up by the Bible. Mike, I appreciate your encouraging words. Do your preachers want you to call them Reverend? Yes, of course. They put the titles on church marquees and their bulletins and on their business cards. You see that. If you talk to someone who is involved with a religious group where they refer to their person as Reverend, you'll see it probably on the business card, or they may have a sign on the desk or maybe a sign on the door which says Reverend so-and-so. When they introduce themselves, oftentimes it's going to be, I'm Reverend so-and-so. You find with a Catholic priest, they'll say, I'm Father so-and-so. If it's a Catholic cardinal or a Catholic bishop, it's probably, I'm Cardinal so-and-so. I'm Bishop so-and-so. They seem to love those titles. He goes on to say, well, it's their title, I guess. Randall was thinking again and then spoke up. Isn't that something? Men who would require other men to call them by a spiritual title with a word that's used in the Bible exclusively for God's name. Part of that may be the way that people present themselves. I'm involved in a jury trial right now. Not that I'm one of the participating parties, but they selected a jury. They seated a jury. Took all day Tuesday. I'm on that jury as an alternate. So I get to do all the things that a jury would normally do, except at the end cast my vote whether or not the person is guilty or not guilty. And today we were there by and we're ready to go by 9 o'clock, and they've got 12 other people plus one other alternate in the room, and we're all there waiting, you know, talking about a few things. And the guy at the end of the table, I don't know if he's going to turn out to be the jury foreman or not, he just shoots a look to me and says, would you lead us in a prayer? I was shocked. I was shocked for a couple of reasons. I mean, because of the questioning, it came up that I was a preacher, so if they were listening, they knew that that was my profession. And we're going to hear a lot about jury trials on Sunday. I'm just going to give you a warning because of how this week has gone. It's not only going to be Sunday morning, you're going to get it Sunday night, because I left the courthouse at 6:30, so my week this week has pretty much been spent at the courthouse. So anyway, we have to make some adjustments. But anyway, I found that very, very interesting. And I don't know that it's been my demeanor, but people have not treated me in any way that's special. And that's right. That's good. But they've not looked like, well, you know, we can't talk to you, or we can't touch you, or we can't sit by you. If anything, I guess they feel like that I'm somebody who can, you know, they can talk to. So this fella, after the prayer, and that was interesting. You know, I guess prayers can come out just like any other speech in a lot of different ways. So this isn't really related to class, but I'll just let you have this little detail too. So he asked me to lead the prayer. I did. And it just happened to be one of those times where it just came out perfectly. I mean, I think the length was right. I think the content of the prayer was right. And they just, I had one lady said, did you practice that prayer? I said, well, no, I didn't. It was the power of the Holy Spirit. So I just figured, well, probably not. But we're not gonna get into all that. But anyway, jury trials can be really interesting. But when people start talking about preachers, you get some very interesting reactions. Sometimes people care less, and sometimes they go to the opposite extreme where they think that you are a reverend. But anyway, this fella who asked me to lead the prayer, at lunchtime, I happened to walk down to Dairy Queen. And he drove down there, but you know, he said, hey, could I join you for lunch? And I said, well, yeah. So we're talking a little bit, and it didn't take very long into the lunch discussion where he said, I'm a felon. I thought, So, you know, he explained a little bit about that. That kind of surprised me that he would qualify for the jury. But anyway, he goes into some of his background and just starts, you know, talking about some things, which, for the most part, I was still kind of a complete stranger. But I'm telling you that if you don't give off a false religious air like some of these guys do, people feel like they can communicate with you. But if you get into what Carol, I think, was talking about earlier, you're the laity, I'm the clergy, you're down here, I'm up here, that's not God's plan, and it's actually contrary to God's plan. But a lot of people are not willing to live their lives in that way, and maybe there are a lot of reasons for that. But anything that you want to add or ask before we move on a little further? Don?
Back to the word reverend.
Okay.
And he quotes Psalm 111:9.
Psalm 119, I think.
No,
111:9, yes, I'm sorry.
And all the translations I have, NASB, the King James, NIV, and ESV, do not have the word reverend.
Yeah, and that's why I say, I think if you look at that word, the idea there is exalted and not reverend in the sense that we think of it. So,
well, appointment, but he's using this to make a point. And it doesn't, if somebody's picking up these translations, then it's not there.
Yeah.
So he's using something that's old.
Yeah. And that's why I say that is not the place where I go. If I'm going to discuss that with somebody, I don't think that is the best place. Now, you could make that additional point that if you look at other translations, especially some that have been done in the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years, you're likely not going to find Reverend. Maybe you will find that referenced in a footnote. But that is correct. And if somebody were reading this book and they had one of those newer translations, they might look at that and think, I don't see it there. Maybe it's a misprint, or maybe it's just a translation difference.
Maybe he's not doing his homework.
Well, that could be. Sometimes a person will use a specific translation and not check others. That may have happened in this case. I can't really comment as far as what was in the writer's mind. But when you think about, for example, Matthew chapter 23, Jesus there talks about religious titles such as Father. He says, you're all brethren. That should make it pretty clear that we don't have a reverend in the group. You do have sometimes some distinctive titles, for example. If a person were designated as an apostle, I mean, that's going to set them apart as far as they have some different roles, some different functions. But would you say that Peter was going to be a super Christian in the eyes of God compared to the other guy who was still out there in the fishing boat? Or Martha? Or Mary? No. They were all on the same level, but they were going to have different functions, just like people today. All right, so thank you for bringing that up. Anybody else? Let's see where we stopped. Let's go to the top of page 251. Even though I was in a hurry to leave, he had my interest. Mr. Mike, Jesus covered this issue 2,000 years ago. Now, he approaches it, again, from a slightly different standpoint than I might, but he goes over to John 12, 42 and 43. Nevertheless, even of the chief rulers, many believed on him, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. For they love the praise of men more than the glory of God. You have in the world, and this would be true in the church as well, but you also certainly find it in the denominational world, some people, they crave the glory of men. Now, that's not limited to just preachers. Do you think there are some people who check their Facebook posts to see how many likes they got? Yep. I brush my teeth 3 times a day, and they want to make sure that 40 people have, put a little happy smile on there because they brushed their teeth. I don't know that that's it, but whatever it is. But people sometimes, they want that recognition. They want to feel like they have the approval of others. So that can be a problem for all people, but especially with some religious folks, they figure that they've earned the degree or they have status in their religious group and they want to make sure that they receive it. And sometimes, we talked about this last time a little bit as far as why, this was in Sunday's class, about the priests. Remember why some would have stayed with the old system and didn't want to go to the new? Part of that was status, part of that was money, a job change, and you see the same thing with tonight's material. He asks about the glory of men. Yeah, Mike, the glory that they receive in part by the prestige that comes with their title of reverend, Randall explained. And denominational preachers today can be likened to the Pharisees in the first century who love the praise of men and love their titles. I understand that some of today's preachers will even get angry if you don't address them by their religious title. That happens. I've had that experience. Maybe some of you have had that same issue. If a person says, well, I'm Reverend so-and-so, or this is my religious title, that's how I expect you to address me. If you don't do that, you're kind, you say, for example, I don't feel that I can biblically address you as Father or Lord God the Pope or whatever it might be, they get upset because that is their title. And in their mind, it would be a matter of disrespect. You're not recognizing the authority that they claim to have, and that is a problem. Anything that you want to add or ask? Don?
Just a comment. He said, the denominational preachers seem to love. He doesn't say some or many or whatever. In other words, he's saying every denominational preacher prays.
And again, that's why I try, when you have those all-inclusive statements, to tone that down a little bit. Because when you start saying all or everyone or each one, you have to make sure. I mean, we might say all the lights are on tonight. And we can look up and count. Okay, if we've got 12 lights up there, they're all 12 on, we can say that's true. But when you start looking at people, we can sometimes be in a hurry and make a broad generalization that may not be true. And that's exactly right. When you start talking about people who love that kind of title, that certainly would not be true of everybody. Now, that might be true of many, perhaps even the majority, but not everyone. Okay, that it? Looking down to about the middle of page 251. Yeah, Mike, the glory that they receive in part is the prestige that comes with their title of reverend. And denominational preachers today can be like, oh, we got that, the Pharisees. Now that you mention it, I had a minister get a little irritated with me in one of my repair calls. He wanted to be called reverend. He goes back to Matthew 23, call no man your father on the earth, Matthew 23 and verse 9, for one is your father who is in heaven. Now, every once in a while, we talked before, if you recall that discussion about people, they are presented with information and they will just say stupid, silly stuff. Remember that sermon we talked about 20 ridiculous Bible verses a couple Sundays ago? I went through, we had the charts with the interesting items on them. And in that sermon, I talked about the fact that people sometimes say, well, what about the space alien? Did Jesus die for the space alien? Does the Martian have to be baptized? They would just bring up ridiculous things because they don't want to face the truth. You have a similar argument made in Matthew chapter 23, and I've had this come up on various occasions. They'll say, well, call no man your father on the earth. What did you call your dad? Didn't you call him father? And there's that taunting tone. Well, yes, I did. Well, the Bible says don't call him father, and you did. Come on. Do we really have to go through this to the point where you think that is referring to your little earthly father? Okay, if that's really what you believe, then let's look at the context. Generally, though, they're not wanting to look at the context. They just have this idea, or they want to pick at you, and they have that gotcha question that we talked about in that sermon. He says, I can see that. This is the page before the chapter ends. Randall said, even the Apostle Peter, when Cornelius fell down to offer his worship, told Cornelius to stand up for what? I myself am also a man. Can you see how that relates to the point that Carol was making earlier? What about the clergy-lady system? I'm way up here. I'm this special servant of God, and where are you? Next to the dirt. That's not what Peter said. I myself am also a man. Remember when Paul and his companion, the gods have come down to us. What do they say? I mean, they're tearing their clothes and saying, that's not true, guys. We are men of like passions. We're just like you. Randall, I've learned more from you in these last 3 days than I have in a lifetime from Sunday school classes. Now, let's pause there for a second. Do you think that this was just because Randall was some super Christian? Or do you think this should be true of any Christian? Should be true of any Christian. And we might have to study a little bit more. We might have to do a little more digging than Randall did. But if people are willing to talk, if people are willing to communicate, what should they be taking away from every discussion that we have? Truth, Bible knowledge. They should be growing in the grace and knowledge of Christ. And it might take them a long time before they can put all the puzzles, all the pieces in the puzzle together. But little by little, what they have been taught that's incorrect, that should be untaught in the minds of people. And they should be having truth instilled little by little. So you have the encouragement. Mr. Mike, just keep studying your Bible. The power is in the Word. I'm just a servant, but I'm grateful to God for your wonderful encouragement. Appreciate your time, Randall. You've got it, my friend. The Bible refers to preachers as evangelists. It does not refer to them as a reverend, a father, or a pastor. Pastor, the church doesn't call the preacher pastor. That generates another discussion. No way, man, but we'll talk about that tomorrow. Anything that you might not ever ask over that chapter? Brian?
Paul called Timothy his son. Does that set up any kind of relationship?
Well, when you think about the church, I think you have to look at that in terms of a spiritual family. We're all brethren. Christ has adopted us as sons. You think about... let's take a look at Titus 2. I'm thinking that's... Treat the elder women as mothers. Older men as fathers. Is it 1 Timothy? My brain's about fried from today.
Yeah, it's 1 Timothy 5:2.
Okay, thank you. Yes, that's it. Rebuke not an elder, but exhort him as a father. The younger men as brethren. The elder women as mothers. The younger as sisters in all purity. I think that would be a good parallel to the point that you were bringing out from that verse, that as a son, we're looking at it in terms of a spiritual family.
Yes.
Yes. But again, you have there that family relationship. Not that we're blood ties, but in Christ we have this spiritual union, and it's like a big family. You know, you've got some people who are leading the family, you've got spiritually immature people, small kids in the family, and in many respects that is the best illustration for the church.
Christians are referred to as a royal priesthood. There may be another place where Christians are called priests. Does that ever set up a situation where someone felt like they could assume a title?
Okay, you're thinking of 1 Peter 2, verses 5, and especially verse 9. When you ask, do you think that somebody could assume a title from that? Do you mean, for example, I'm your priest?
I'm asking the question. I don't know. I've never heard of that. I was just wondering if anybody had ever heard that that had happened.
Well, within the church, I've never heard of that specific thing happening. I mean, I think that might be a hard sell for a lot of people. If Christ is our priest, then the question, I think, in a lot of minds would be, then, if he's the priest, then how would you, as a quote-unquote priest, factor into that? But you do have some other things that have been tried. For example, how many remember the Crossroads movement from 20-plus years ago? Okay, that sort of swept through the church, and it's still something that's a problem in some foreign countries right now. Anybody remember what the big title was if you were involved with the Crossroads church? You have a what partner? You have a
prayer
partner. And the way that was set up, the prayer partner, if you were to, let's see how I want to frame the question. I don't want to give away the answer. You have the prayer partner and you have the person who is going to fulfill the other role. How would you, based on your knowledge of the Crossroads movement, define or describe those two folks?
One is more mature in the faith than the other one.
Yes. And because of that maturity, you not only have that designation, but you also have superiority. And if you look at this, it was a system which was a hierarchical system. You have the person, let's say, at ground level, and that person is going to do the reporting to the prayer partner. And then that prayer partner is going to do some reporting to the person who is above him. And I'm not sure what that third level was. And then from that third level, you're... pyramid is going to get narrow and narrow as you obviously go up further towards the top. And then eventually you get towards the top dog, so to speak. Now, he's probably not interested in all the stuff that's going on with 1,000 people down here. He's probably interested in managing the organization. But again, that was how it worked. You know, you just have these various levels step by step. So you would have, specifically, in that type of arrangement, people fulfilling different roles. Now, they may have had, like I say, different titles other than prayer partner for that, but that was how that was arranged. And that's a fairly recent example.
Chip Key was a big leader in that Crossroads movement.
Yeah.
My cousin Larry was very involved in that, and he and his wife, Martha, it's now called the International Churches of Christ, the Crossroads movement, but they were in London for a few years trying to get that going.
Yeah. The head has... Again, I think the wheels have pretty much come off the organization for the most part, and it's gone through several transitions. But yes, McKean was at the top for a while, and then I don't know if it was a power struggle or what happened. Maybe one got bored with it, but that switched hands as far as the top person.
Based out of Boston.
Yeah.
Mother.
Yeah. Crossroads movement, Boston movement, there were multiple designations for it. Jenny? Okay.
But anyway, there was a girl that I knew there at school who got involved with that, and her prayer partner or accountability partner or whatever. I remember she had to, like, report to her about everything she was doing, and she was hanging out with, and how school was going, and her grades. And,
yeah. Kids, marriage life, and as I say, there was that... Anything else, it's like a fad. It shows up. Sometimes young people are the ones who are first sucked into it, and it just spreads like wildfire. But in this case, it was a cult. That it? Okay, let's see. We've got about 5 minutes left. This is probably a little bit more material than we can finally completely knock off. So let's get as far as we can. Going back to 254, Morning comes, he brings in the coffee and donuts. "Hey, Mr. Mike," Randall said. Then he hollered when he saw the donuts. "You know the weight of my heart, and it's definitely through my stomach." He says, "I know you probably want to talk about some more specific things this morning, but we push that to tomorrow." "Sure." He says, "What do you want to talk about?" He says, "Christ, the members of your congregation don't call their preachers pastors. Why is that?" Well, again, that's a good Bible question, common Bible question, and that's a question that we should be able to answer pretty much off the bat. Randall opens up the Bible. He says the term pastor comes from the Greek word poimen or poimeno, and that word means shepherd. He mentions two. You'll notice that he leaves out one. There are actually six different words that are translated or convey the idea of elder and the meaning of elder in the New Testament. One word would be bishop, another would be overseer, another word would be pastor, shepherd, bishop. He's got overseer in there twice, and elder. You've also got presbyter that's not mentioned. He said our English word for pastor, which comes from these Greek words, poimen and poimeno, is found only one time in the New Testament, and it's over in Ephesians chapter 4. And there God said, and gave some apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers. He then begins to define those words. What's an evangelist?
Preacher.
You think about someone who is a herald. Way back when? Going back to, I don't know, probably not in the 1900s, but in the 1800s. What was a town crier? Anybody familiar with that terminology? The town crier. Yeah, that was pretty much it. You get your newspaper from the guy who's running up and down the streets. He was crying out information. Well, we've modernized that a little bit in a lot of ways, but yes, there was a town crier. So it's not been uncommon throughout time to use people to communicate various messages, send them out from the housetops, or have them go up and down the streets and share information. We have that with Christianity. It's changed a little bit as far as how that might be done, but still, that's what we have. And he mentions that the apostles, we know who they were. The evangelists, we've defined them. You have the prophets, and then you have some who are pastors. That's who we're talking about now. And the teachers are also easy to understand. He says the pastors were separate from the apostles. Now, you could have an apostle who was also a pastor, an elder, presbyter, bishop? Sure. And how do we know that? Peter was. 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. Peter talks about the fellow elders. Well, if Peter wasn't an elder, then that didn't make sense. But if he was an elder, then they would have some fellow elders. Could you have an evangelist or preacher who's an elder? Yes. Well, I don't know if you can argue successfully that Titus was an elder. Maybe I got tongue twisted there. Could you have a preacher who was also an elder or a bishop?
Yes.
Okay. If I didn't ask my question correctly, I apologize, but that was what I intended to ask. Okay. He says, I cut in. You mentioned during our study Tuesday that each congregation was independent of the rest, self-governed by pastors or elders. So, and here's the biggie, the preacher doesn't make the decisions. Is that what you said? I asked, trying to remember our previous conversation. Yeah, that's right, replied Randall. So the preacher is not the pastor. No, Mr. Mike, in the New Testament, we find that the evangelist and the pastor are not the same man. There are cases where that can be the same, but there are also cases where that is not the same. And there are always more than one pastor at each congregation? Yes, yes. Absolutely, just as Paul and the apostles commanded. Could you show me where that's found in the Bible? And then he gives a number of passages, starting with Acts 11:30, going through 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 1 through 5, and that's where I'm going to have to shut it down tonight. Anything that went at or asked before we stopped this evening? Okay.